Your call is now live.
Good morning, everyone. This is Bill at Leading Age New York welcoming you to new and updated information on CMOS. This program will address the new opportunity for providers to enter into an agreement with managed long-term care plans to provide care management services. Speaking today will be Brian McGovern and Stephanie Marcantonio from Cadwalader, Wickersham & Taft, as well as Patrick Cuccinelli from Leading Age New York. The stage is yours.
Thanks, Bill. Good morning, everyone. I want to apologize for the fact that Cheryl is not here, a little bit of a personal emergency that couldn't be avoided. And one of the reasons I'm really sorry that Cheryl couldn't be here is because she was one of the prime people who really pushed this issue and got this issue started with DOH, and it would have been really nice for her to do the presentation, but I will try my best to fill in. You should have gotten your materials off of our website. On our website, you'll see that we have specific objectives for this session. We want to go over the history of the Care Management Administrative Services, or CMAS, agreement. We want to discuss what providers are eligible to enter into this agreement. We want to review the critical components of such an agreement. There are three important documents that have been provided on our website. And we also want to discuss the general issues that you need to consider when entering into a CMOS agreement. Now, among the documents that you should have gotten off of our website is a November 30th, 2012 letter from the Department of Health to the MLTC plans. This was the first letter put out by DOH indicating that the option for multiple CMOS agreements is out there. There's then a subsequent letter to that letter dated December 27th, which is also on our website, in which there were certain refinements made based upon input from Leading Age and other associations. You have an actual sample of what the Care Management Administrative Services Contract Guidelines for Managed Long-Term Care Plans look like. And finally, there are two PowerPoints. One of the PowerPoints is the Leading Age PowerPoint, which I will cover instead of Cheryl. And then there you have a detailed PowerPoint from Stephanie and Brian from Cadwalader on CMOS. So with that said, we'll move into the slide presentation entitled New and Updated Information on Care Management Administrative Services with Leading Age in the bottom right-hand corner. And you see the agenda there, and you should note that we will have time for question Q&A at the end of the presentation. We'll open up the lines. Also want to remind people that this is a free session, and there are no credits being offered. However, the session will be recorded and should be available shortly after this is done. So if there's other people on your staff who you feel should be participating in this or listening to this, this will be on our website, and people can listen to it for free. I am now moving on to the slide entitled CMAS Background. And it starts out, this is a new opportunity for certain providers to enter into an agreement with managed long-term care plans to provide managed care management services. And as I said, this goes back to, I can remember, a specific meeting between the Department of Health and Leading Age New York, in which Cheryl Udell pushed the issue of making this opportunity available for providers like long-term home health care plans, certified home health agencies, licensed home care services agencies, and adult day health care providers. And the problem or challenge that we faced initially was, under the original interpretation of the regulations, a single managed long-term care plan could only contract with a single administrator, who would be one of those types of agencies, for administrative services. We felt very strongly about the fact that we advocated that this is really an opportunity for the LICSAs, the CHAs, the Lombardi programs to enter into this new managed, to continue to play an important role in the new managed long-term care environment. And we also felt there was a win-win in terms of the managed long-term care plans, who now are expanding at a very rapid rate and have to come into, for example, upstate areas, which is new territory for them, to utilize infrastructure that's already in place there through the long-term healthcare programs or the adult day healthcare programs or the CHAs and facilitate their ability to expand and cover these new areas. So all of this was occurring during the spring and the summer of last year. And we were looking to facilitate the contracting process, eliminate some of the bureaucratic barriers, and we advocated strongly on that. We developed a revised management services agreement, Part 98, which allowed for the sole agreement clause. And with the new agreement, you now have a blend of managed services agreements and provider agreements. Moving on to the slide entitled CMOS Background Continued. During the fall and winter of 2012, that's when we really got down to the nuts and bolts of drafting the document that you now have in front of you, the New York State Department of Health Care Management Administrative Services Contract Guidelines for Managed Long-Term Care Plans. And there was a lot of back and forth between the associations. Brian McGovern and Stephanie were very instrumental in helping to represent Leading Age on this issue and drafting a document that we felt really helped to bring these providers into a better position to negotiate and become administrators in terms of providing services for the managed long-term care plans. These were first published in November 30th of 2012, with revisions subsequent to that on December 27th and January 2nd. Moving on to the next slide, entitled Who is the Administrator? As I mentioned before, in terms of the types of providers who could be administrators, it is your Lombardis, it is your LICSAs, your CHAs, and your adult day healthcare programs. Programs that we believe, as an association, really have strong background in providing management services, care planning, and managing individuals' care. And this is really, in this new world of managed long-term care, such a provider choosing the contract with an MLTC to provide administrative services then becomes the administrator. Brian, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
We will go into a further discussion when we get to our slides on the definition of an administrator and what functions an administrator may or may not provide, and we'll get into further detail when we get into our slides.
Okay, good. Moving on to the slide entitled What is Care Management Services? Care management services means the delegation by the managed care organization of the process that assists enrollees to access necessary covered services as identified in the care plan. It also provides referral and coordination of other services in support of that care plan. Care management services assists enrollees to obtain needed medical, social, educational, psychosocial, financial, and other services in support of the care plan, irrespective of whether the needed services are covered under the capitation payment to the MCO. Moving next to the slide entitled Care Plan, Person-Centered Service Plan. The care plan in this type of arrangement is a written description in the care management record of the member of specific health care goals to be achieved, the amount, duration, the scope of the covered services to be provided to that enrollee in order to achieve those goals. The person-centered individual service plan is based on assessment of the member's health care needs and developed in consultation with the member and his or her informal supports. The plan includes consideration of the current and unique psychosocial and medical needs and history of the enrollee, as well as the person's functional level and support systems. Effectiveness of the person-centered service plan is monitored through reassessment and a determination as to whether the health goals are being met. Non-covered services, which interrelate with the covered services identified on the plan and services of informal supports necessary to support the healthcare goals and effectiveness of the covered services, should be clearly identified on the person-centered service plan or elsewhere in the care management record. basically what we're talking about here is really a very comprehensive care plan for that individual that is developed in conjunction with the managed long-term care plan and with the other informal support group services that are out there, for example, family members, a spouse, a son, or a daughter. And with that, we'll open up for any questions as far as this introductory piece is concerned.
Yes, sir. At this time, if you have a question or a comment, please press 1 now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue.
And let me just note here, too, that we've been joined in the room by Christine Fitzpatrick. So if there are any questions specifically for Adult Day Healthcare, we've got an expert on that here as well. Are there any questions at this time?
We do have a question from Mary Palmer.
Hey, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. Franklin County Nursing Home. My question is this relevant to skilled nursing facilities?
Yeah, I mean, if I may, we will cover in the slides, Mary, in a moment, which entities are eligible to serve as an administrator. But an Article 28 licensed facility, including a nursing home, would be eligible to serve as an administrator to perform the care management administrative services that are contemplated under this arrangement. So this would not be, this would be a nursing home or any other eligible entity providing not nursing home care, but the technical and administrative services, which we'll get into further, involving care management. So in that respect, it could be an opportunity for a nursing home as well.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
At this time, there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, thank you. With that, then, I'll turn the program over to Brian, who is working with the PowerPoint with the Cadwallader logo on it, entitled Care Management Services Contracting. This will be Brian and Stephanie.
Thank you, Patrick. This is Brian. Thank you for that overview. And thank you, Bill, for arranging the call, and appreciate the opportunity to speak with Leading Age New York members on this important subject. So now we're on the Cadwallader slides, and I now want to turn to slide 2 of the Cadwallader set, and note that among the materials that Patrick mentioned are attached and distributed are 3 key documents that were promulgated by the Department of Health that will really shape and define the nature and the scope of care management administrative services and the contractual relationship between a long-term managed care plan and the, quote, administrator, and that's the entity that would be actually furnishing the care management administrative services. And they're referenced on slide 2, as I said. They include the CMAS, to use that acronym, guidelines, the standard clauses, and the certification form. The guidelines are just as the title indicates, guidelines that will govern the contract between an administrator and a plan. And the standard clauses are provisions that must be incorporated with any care management administrative services contract entered into after December 1, 2012. The last form is this certification form that a managed long-term care plan must complete and submit with each proposed CMAS contract for Department of Health approval, as well as with any amendments, so quote, material amendments that it must be submitted also to DOH for approval. The remaining slides in our presentation will refer to and at other times try to explain and synthesize the 3 core documents. So to provide members interested in this opportunity a clearer understanding of, you know, what is entailed in undertaking care management administrative services, you know, what terms are part of the standard clauses and what they mean, and what terms and provisions are not addressed or left to the negotiations between the plans and the administrator. And the slides will cover, among other topics, the payments provisions in the guidelines and standard clauses, the term of the agreement, including the provisions for termination or renewal, the requirements with respect to subcontracting if you are an administrator and seeking to outsource a portion of the services to another entity. The slides will cover the administrator's performance and other obligations under the standard clauses, as well as the formidable disclosure requirements. And the slides will also cover the plan's obligations and limits on what they can or cannot require an administrator to do. And we will also point out as we go through these slides what issues and terms are left for negotiation between the plan and the administrator, and the issues that an administrator contemplating entering into this contract should consider in connection with any negotiation. So we are now going to turn to slide 3 of the presentation, and I'm going to turn over the balance of the presentation to my colleague Stephanie Marcantonio, who has been working in conjunction with me and Leading Age New York in understanding and assisting Leading Age New York in the development of these guidelines and standard clauses. Stephanie, do you want to take over at this point?
Sure. Thank you, Brian. And I'm also going to invite both you, Brian, and Patrick to jump in through the course, the remainder of the program, if there's anything else that I'm overlooking. But as Brian said, moving to slide 3, and I think this is, Brian had mentioned this in his introduction, these three documents promulgated by the Department of Health should guide the contracting process any time that a eligible provider entity is contracting with a managed long-term care plan to provide care management services on behalf of the plan. Moving to slide 4, these guidelines are applicable to any care management contract submitted to the Department of Health on or after December 1st, 2012. For those contracts that were submitted before then, they will stand as is until I believe they are, by their terms, in need of renewal. It is not clear what the procedures might be for agreements that were submitted on or after December 1st, but before the clauses were finalized, or the standard clauses were finalized, because there was some adjustment to them, but we would hope that the parties would have an opportunity to, rather than the standard clauses just being attached to the agreements and assumed to be applicable, we would hope that the parties would have a chance to revisit the agreement and address any matters that might be impacted by the application of the standard clauses and the guidelines. Moving to slide 5 through 7, in these we identify those functions that a managed care organization may not delegate pursuant to 10 NYCRR section 98111 I and J, or I, and those that they may only delegate pursuant to a management contract pursuant to section 98111 J. The first set includes functions such as hiring or terminating their CEO, adoption of budgets and independent control of books and records, authority over the disposition of assets and the authority to incur liabilities not normally associated with day-to-day operations. Adoption or enforcement of policies affecting the operation of the managed care organization, oversight of management functions that have been delegated to a management contractor, and the primary responsibility for the development and implementation of fraud and abuse prevention plans. Now, those are the functions that a managed care organization cannot delegate. They always have to reside with the governing authority. Then we, on slide 6, we begin the list of elements that may be delegated pursuant to a management contract, but these functions are not care management functions that would be subject to these terms. These documents promulgated by the Department of Health, they would be subject to, they could be delegated to the same entity, but they would have to be pursuant to a separate agreement that was governed by the management contracting guidelines promulgated by the Department of Health.
So just if I could just interject there, Stephanie, just for the listeners, the Department of Health also has promulgated guidelines and standard clauses for contracts with providers who actually provide medical or other health services, and they also have promulgated guidelines and standard clauses for management agreements. And now with this set, this set of guidance and clauses govern care management administrative services. So you may continue,
okay.
Stephanie?
Moving to slide 8, Patrick earlier spoke about who an administrator is or could be. We just want to note that an administrator may contract with more than one plan to provide care management services, and a plan may contract with more than one administrator to provide those services. However, the plan may only assign one administrator to an enrollee at any given time. Moving to slides 9 and 10, we've listed the type of providers that are eligible to serve as an administrator providing care management services, and Patrick had touched on this earlier. Specifically, they include an Article 28 healthcare facility, such as a nursing home, an Article 36 home care agencies, including CHAS or LHCSAs, a medical model adult day health program, and a facility or service licensed or certified under the mental hygiene law. In addition, an IPA, an independent practice association made up of those previously mentioned provider types, is also eligible to serve as an administrator. And the guidelines leave room for the Department of Health to approve other types of entities if approved as capable of rendering care management services. However, the administrator must possess demonstrated expertise and experience in the coordination of long-term care services, and it or an affiliated entity must be eligible to participate in the New York State Medicaid program. And furthermore, it must agree to comply with all applicable state and federal laws and regulations and the Medicaid program requirements. Moving to slide 11. What other services can be provided? The parties to the care management agreement may use this one agreement to cover both the care management services and other technical and administrative services that don't fall into the care management category, as well as medical services. If medical services are going to be provided, however, the agreement has to also comply with the provider contract guidelines Brian had previously mentioned. The department has promulgated guidelines and standard clauses that apply to provider contracts between a provider and a managed care plan, and both sets of guidelines and standard clauses would be applicable if you're going to try to do everything in one contract. as we noted earlier, a care management contract cannot include management services. For that, a separate agreement must be executed, which complies with the management contract guidelines for MCOs promulgated by the Department of Health, and the agreement must be approved by the department. However, there is nothing that precludes the same entity that provides care management services from entering into a management agreement with that plan. I'd also like to note that the provision of assessments, of solely assessment or reassessment services by a provider on behalf of a plan are not care management services that would rise to the level of requiring, that would be subject to the guidelines and the standard clauses.
So just if I could just clarify on that one point, Stephanie, while care management administrative services will ordinarily include assessment and reassessment of enrollees, a managed care plan may contract specifically and solely the assessment function to another entity or agency without having to be subject to the guidelines and standard clauses that we're discussing today.
Thank you, Brian. Moving to slide 12, what do the guidelines and standard clauses require with respect to payment? Although the payment terms of a care management agreement are otherwise negotiable, the parties must agree that the payments are reasonable and will not jeopardize the plan's financial security. Because there's no way for the provider or administrator to know what terms would jeopardize a managed care organization's financial security, we suggest that in negotiating a contract that administrators seek a representation from the plan about its financial security. We anticipate that most care management contracts will be for a flat rate. Pursuant to the guidelines and standard clauses, the administrator is precluded from assuming financial risk for care coordination services. However, the certification form provides that the administrator may be paid based on PMPM capitation, percentage of revenue, or financial incentives other than fee-for-service. And the Department of Health has not yet provided any additional clarity on this point. Slide 13 talks about the term of the agreement. The guidelines and the standard clauses require that the term be no longer than 5 years. The agreement, in addition, the agreement must be submitted to the Department of Health 45 days prior to its effective date. The agreement itself may provide that it will go into effect 45 days from that submission. However, there needs to be language in the agreement that the parties will agree to incorporate any changes requested by the Department of Health or to terminate the agreement if requested by the department. Moving to slide 14. Material amendments and subcontracts must also be submitted for approval to the Department of Health at least 45 days prior to their implementation. Pursuant to the guidelines and standard clauses, material amendments include but are not limited to changes to the contract provisions required by the guidelines or standard clauses, any change to or addition of a risk-sharing arrangement other than a routine trending of fees and other reimbursement amounts. And again, there is this concept in here of risk-sharing arrangements that seems to be inconsistent with the requirement that the administrator is precluded from assuming financial risk. The addition of an exclusivity, most favored nation, or non-compete clause, and any proposed subcontracting of the statutory or regulatory responsibilities of the plan and any proposed revocation of an approved subcontract. The exclusivity clause would be where an administrator would agree not to contract with any other plan, or where a plan would agree not to contract with any other administrator. And a most favored nation clause would be one where the plan would, for instance, could unilaterally reduce its negotiated rate with the administrator, where a competing plan has negotiating a lower rate with the administrator.
If I just may interject, Stephanie, I think it's notable that a approval of an amendment that would include an exclusivity clause or a most favored nation clause would have to get approval from the Department of Health. I think as we've discussed in prior webinars, you know, the Department of Health views with disfavor exclusivity clauses and any clauses of that nature that, you know, would restrict, you know, opportunities. So I think by requiring an amendment, the department is stating the position that it will not allow two parties to provide for a most favored nation or exclusivity clause without the department's assent.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, Brian. Moving this to the next slide, slide 15. Early termination or non-renewal of a contract will also require at least 45 days notice to the Department of Health. However, the administrator may be terminated by the plan on less than 45 days notice if the plan demonstrates that imminent harm to enrollees is threatened or the administrator is legally unable to deliver the care management services. And the plan may immediately terminate the agreement in the event the administrator is terminated or suspended from the Medicaid program. In this connection, we recommend that the parties negotiate and incorporate into the agreement a provision for advance notice of grounds for termination and an opportunity for the administrator to implement corrective action to cure the default prior to termination, and you know, possibly prior to notification of the Department of Health that they would have, you know, for instance, a 30-day material breach provision on either side, and if there is thought to be a breach, either party would notify the other with 30 days opportunity to cure that breach before further action is taken. In slides 16 and 17, we outline the performance obligations of the administrator. I'm not going to read them to you, but I want to point out that one of these obligations is to comply with the plan's contract with the state, excuse me, to the extent it's pertinent to the administrator's performance, including the confidentiality requirements. In this connection, we recommend that the administrator request a copy of the state contract to review. We also, although there are confidentiality requirements imposed on the administrator by reference to the state contract, we would also recommend that the negotiated agreement impose confidentiality obligations on the plan to the extent it will have access to information of the administrator and the processes it uses for care management. In slides 18 and 19, we list out the administrator's disclosure requirements. Most of these requirements have to do with information the administrator is required to provide to the plan, including that the administrator is required to disclose to the managed care organization complete ownership, control, and relationship information. However, those three terms, ownership, control, and relationship, are not defined in the in the guidelines or the standard clauses. So it's somewhat unclear how far that relationship information has to go. For instance, if you're part of a group of affiliated entities. Others of these obligations have to do with certain information that must be disclosed to state agencies, such as the Department of Health, CMS, or OMIG, upon request. We note that in the standard clauses, there is a typo in Section B7 pertaining to the right of the plan and state agencies to monitor and evaluate the performance of the administrator under the contract and to have access to records. The last sentence provides that this provision shall survive the termination of the CMS contract regardless of the reason, but shall be coterminous with the retention periods, and that's for records provided for in Standard Clause D4. That should be a reference to D5, which provides for a 6-year retention period after the date of service, and in the case of a minor, for 3 years after the majority or 6 years after the date of service, whichever is later. The guidelines are silent as to which party should bear the cost of these disclosure requirements, other than the Department of Health should not bear the cost. We suggest that any agreement negotiated with a managed care organization require that the plan will pay for the cost of any copies of requested documentation, or that those obligations be considered when you're negotiating a rate.
Stephanie, if I may just interject before you move on to the plan obligations section of your presentation, I just wanted to circle back on a couple of points that you made regarding the performance obligations of an administrator. And they're formidable. They include following the policies and procedures that are established or imposed by the managed care organization. But the language does state that those obligations are, you know, subject to 30 days advance notice. So there is a basis under the standard clauses for at least requiring advance notice, 30 days, of any policies or policy changes that the managed care plan may require an administrator to comply with. And one other note, too, that the administrator will be required to take any corrective action that the plan identifies in performance or to implement any needed improvements. And the guidelines in reference written notice to the administrator. So at least you have to be notified. And I think that's where this provision would dovetail with a provision that would provide the administrator with an opportunity to cure any default or deficiency before the plan would act to terminate the agreement for noncompliance. And lastly, I wanted to note too that that an administrator has to perform the monthly checks of the exclusion lists just as a provider would, and has to preclude any excluded employees from performing under the CMAS contract with the plan. So that's all I wanted to just note with regard to the administrator's obligations. And I guess now I'd turn back to you, Stephanie, to discuss the plan's obligations and limitations on its authority with respect to an administrator on slide 20.
Okay. Thank you. As Brian noted, moving on to slide 20, which identifies the obligations of the plan under the guidelines and standard clauses, they are a lot shorter. The plan may not impose, and this ties into what Brian was just saying, the plan may not impose obligations or duties on the administrator unless it provides advance written notice of those obligations. And it may not impose obligations and duties on the administrator that impair any rights accorded to the Department of Health, the local Department of Social Services, or CMS. And it must make available to the administrator all medical records, personally identifiable information, and other relevant documents and information necessary to satisfactorily allow the administrator to fulfill its obligations pursuant to the contract and the law. In slides 21 through 23, we list the joint obligations of the parties. They include complying with HIPAA and entering into a business associate agreement, being governed by New York law, not transferring liability for either party's own actions or admissions by indemnification or otherwise, and one of them is to, the parties need to agree as to whether the plan will obtain consent directly from enrollees at the time of enrollment, or the administrator will obtain consent at the time services are rendered for the disclosure of medical records to the plan or to third parties for care management services. We recommend that if the administrator will be responsible for obtaining these consents, that the agreement provide that the plan will reimburse the administrator for the associated costs of obtaining the consent, or that the obligation be considered when negotiating a rate. There is also a requirement that the parties indemnify each other from certain liability, including sanctions imposed by OMIG and OIG for its negligent or wrongful actions that are the direct cause of any liability. The language here, I think reasonable minds could differ over exactly what they're requiring be indemnified beyond liability or sanctions arising out of OMIG or OIG action, and accordingly we suggest that the plan also indemnify the administrator against any loss or expense arising out of the plan's or a participating provider's negligent acts or omissions, the plan's breach of its obligations pursuant to the agreement, and any violation of law by the plan or a participating provider. And as noted before, another joint obligation of the parties is to agree that the payment terms are reasonable and do not jeopardize the financial security of the managed care organization. And again, we recommend a representation from the plan to that effect because administrator really doesn't have the, without performing diligence on the plan, which I don't think would be appropriate in this circumstance, it wouldn't have the opportunity to know about the plan's financial security. And finally, slide 23, as mentioned earlier, the parties have an obligation to retain medical records and records relating to the performance under the agreement for a period of 6 years or 3 years after majority of a minor, whichever is later. And to designate a contact person, each party has to designate a contact person for, among other things, dispute resolution issues. And moving to slide 24 through 27, we have highlighted other issues to consider when entering into a care management contract in addition to those we've identified throughout the presentation. They include confirming that the agreement includes what we call standard representations and warranties, that each party has authority to do business, enter into the agreements, is duly licensed, that all plan policies and procedures incorporated into the agreement by reference, whether it's a fraud prevention plan, whatever it might be, if it's referenced in the agreement and you will be responding, the provider or administrator will be responsible for complying with those policies, they should be exchanged and reviewed prior to the execution of the agreement. that the administrator consider how the plan can use its name and service marks and whether there are any limitations or prior approvals you would like in place before they can, for instance, incorporate the administrator's name in their marketing material. The agreement should also be reviewed for a mandatory arbitration provision, although our suggestion would be that although arbitration could be an option, we'd prefer that it not be an exclusive option and that you'd have the opportunity to litigate if at the time an issue arose, you chose to pursue that option. And finally, the agreement should provide that it the agreement should provide that it cannot be assigned by the plan without the consent of the administrator. There is, for assignment, DOH consent is required, but theoretically, if no consent is required on behalf of the administrator, the plan could go ahead and submit for DOH approval of an assignment of the agreement to a different plan without getting the administrator's consent. And this is a basic contracting issue of knowing who you are in a contractual relationship is with. We suggest that you require consent for any assignment. And in connection with our suggestion about indemnification earlier, we also note where there is an indemnification, we suggest there be a corresponding insurance requirement to back up that indemnification. In addition, evergreen renewal clauses. You should consider whether the agreement includes an evergreen clause, which provides for automatic renewal unless either party notifies the other of its intent not to renew the agreement. Generally, we prefer that a renewal of an agreement be that an agreement expire unless it's renewed, rather than the flip. In any renewal situation under the guidelines, DOH would have to be notified 45 days in advance. But without the right to terminate with an automatic renewal, again, the agreement could be automatically submitted and you would be signed up for another term with the plan, unless you have the right to terminate. And which brings to another point, the agreement should be reviewed for whether you have the right to terminate without cause, or either party has the right to terminate without cause, and that is really a balancing of the protection that would give you to, a 30-day without cause termination right, for instance, against the ability of the plan to terminate you as the administrator without cause, and the benefit and the drawbacks of each. And I think that is all I have, Brian.
Thanks, Stephanie, for that presentation. And I think at this point we have time to open up the line for any questions that the leading agent members may have for Patrick, Stephanie, or me, or Christine.
At this time, if you have a question or comment, please press 1 now. Please only press 1 once. If you press it twice, it will remove you from the queue. We do have a question from Judith Draper.
Hey, Stephanie. So I have a general question. What do you do with a plan that's not willing to negotiate revisions because they say it's a standard agreement approved by Department of Health?
That sounds like a familiar question, Judy.
It does, right. Yes. And I thought people would be interested, yeah.
Part of the process is that often the plans will submit their model form of the contract to the department for pre-approval. And if there are no material changes from that form, then it's obviously a lot easier. You don't have to go through a wholesale new review by the Department of Health for each agreement. That said, there is nothing which precludes them from going back to the Department of Health with those changes. And if they were to provide, for instance, a markup of, you know, what their approved model is to this one, so, you know, the DOH could review just those changes and determine if those changes were acceptable to them.
So they could, but if they're not willing, they're just not willing. It's
And there it becomes a contracting business issue. If one party is saying, we won't, you know, we will not negotiate, then it's to the other party to say, well, you know, either I'm willing to accept what you have to offer or I'm not.
Right.
But from a legal perspective, there's nothing precluding them from going back to the Department of Health and seeking approval for the revised contract.
Right. Okay, thank you.
At this time, I have no further questions in the queue.
This is Patrick again from Leading Age. I just want to remind people that all of the materials for today's presentation are on the website under Education, and that this session is recorded and will be available for listening and probably sometime by the end of the day.
This afternoon, yeah.
All right, and also, this is Brian McGovern. Thank you again for listening in, and we'd be happy to answer any questions or follow-up that you may have that you can think of after this session is over.
Again, this is Patrick. We think this is a great opportunity for our providers to be able to find a new avenue of providing service in a new managed care environment. People like Cheryl Udell, Dan Heim, Brian McGovern spent a lot of time negotiating with DOH on this, and I just want to personally express my gratitude to them. And if we could just double-check, there are no more questions?
At this time, I have no questions in the queue.
Okay, everyone, have a great day.
This officially is the conference. Have a great afternoon.